between the time when the oceans drank Atlantis and the rise of the sons of Arius, there was an age undreamed of. And unto this mass movement, destined to bear the jeweled crown of geekdom upon its troubled brow, it is we, mass movement's chroniclers, who alone can tell thee of its saga. Let us tell you of the days of geek adventure.
Hello, boys and girls, and welcome to another episode of Geekorama. This time, I'm talking to Jim Dodge, the author of Theta House and The Bite, just released by Earth Island Books, and Ali Wilkes, the author of Where the Dead Wait, which has just been published by Titan Books. So without further ado, let's meet Jim.
There's a boy. I just realised we've known each other more than 20 years, and this is the first time we've spoken face-to-face.
Has it been that long?
Wow. Yeah, because I moved in here. We moved to here 21 years ago. And you started writing for the first issue of Mass Movement after we moved in here. So, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a long, long time.
It has. Well, we've been in this house about 23 and a half years here. So we weren't here real long before I started either. I did run across a guy the other night at a show that has said he has been a fan of my writing since my Mass Movement days.
Awesome.
I was like, man, that's the first. And he's like, look, he hadn't bought Theta House and The Bite yet, but he's looking forward to it. And I'm like, I have my first real fan. That's awesome.
So you've got your first reviews as well.
Yeah.
So how does it feel to get your first reviews up? Ego-wise.
Yeah, that's probably not the greatest thing. You know, being bipolar, part of that is they call it grandiosity. So it's one of those, I have my wife to keep me in check. She reminds me I'm not all that sometimes. But it's been good. The worst review I've seen was a 4 out of 5 stars, and their only complaint was that Theta House seemed too abrupt. First review was a 5-star from some guy in Croatia, and I didn't even know we had reviewers in Croatia.
Yeah, David's got them everywhere. They are just literally dying everywhere. Because that's the only problem I have with your book. Because you write like James Herb, right? That's a really good thing. But it seems like the ending is always really abrupt.
Gotcha.
And that's probably intentional because it makes the story work. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not a case of, it's a fault. It's not a fault. It's stylistically is how the story works and how Theta House certainly works and how The Bite works. So, you know, ending your stories abruptly is not a bad thing because James Herbert made millions and millions and millions and millions and millions at it. So don't ever take something like that to heart, to get it personally. So
to me, it's more like one last kick in the balls when, you know, it's the whole story's been, you know, those two stories are both pretty brutal to the characters. Mm-hmm. And that the endings are like just one last punch on the way out.
You don't believe in happy endings, though, Jim. Let's be honest, Jim.
Yeah, no, and the other stuff I've written, well, the other book I have that I've finished is the same way. It's, you know, things don't go well even in the end. It's, you know, I mean, I have some stuff that I've written that might be a little more upbeat, but I do tend to come from the dark side.
Well, I mean, do you think that's a product of your upbringing or your literary influences or just the way
I'm sure it's like a lot of things, you know, it's a combination of stuff. Everybody has trauma in their lives. And, you know, like I said, I deal with bipolar disorder. So that's always a thing. And then, you know, I've always liked horror once I was old enough to, well, I say that my parents were letting us watch things too early, but it was one of those, like they say, you know, it scared the crap out of you, but you enjoyed being scared. And what do? You go pick up another book or watch another movie. And I don't know. It's just, my way of looking at it is that, for me at least, writing horror is a way to do terrible things to fictional people.
Rather than going out and doing, you know, fictional things to real people.
Exactly. I think
that's a product of everyone from the 80s, and that we were all allowed to read, you know, like our generation, because we're both Gen X's, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we were, there's the key, we're off to work, let yourself in from school, watch whatever you want from the video shop, we don't care. You know,
yep.
Read whatever books you want. I think that's a product. That's something that's peculiar to our generation. I don't know if it's been beneficial for us or if it's been detrimental. Because I think it taught us to stand on our own 2 feet and do things our own way and find a way to make things happen.
Well, it's the same with my music. You know, when I was a teenager, my mom would buy me the ones with the explicit lyric sticker, but she would say, "Look, I don't care what you listen to as long as I don't have to hear it."
Well, I remember when I used to play stuff too loud. I was about 14 or 15. My old man, to punish me, took the fuse out of the plug of my stereo, and I couldn't figure out why the stereo wasn't working. So, it took me a while to figure that out. But, that's just, that's how inventive you really are, or you really
Yeah,
can
I
be.
really only cranked my music up in the car. In the house, I did tend to keep it down because I didn't want them to come in and take my stereo or my CDs or whatever. But in the car, there was only two volume settings on the stereo. It was off and all the way up.
So, when did your career as a writer start? What made you want to be a writer?
I had already been writing some because, you know, in school there's always these little projects. But when I was 14 and I hit ninth grade, I had a teacher who saw potential, and she pushed me to pursue it. Like, you have the skill to do, or you know, the basic skill. I wrote a lot of poetry back then too. It was poetry and short stories. And she saw some potential, and she pushed me, like, not in a, she encouraged me. Let me put it that way so it doesn't come across like she was being, "Well, you got to do this." But he just encouraged me, like, "You can do this." And I've had, you know, I've self-published a lot of books. I've done a lot of reviews and interviews, mostly for Mass Movement, a few features here and there. But you know, Earth Island picking up Theta House, that's the first time one of my books has been picked up by a legitimate publisher. And I'm 48 years old now. So that's, you know, from 14 to 48 to get to that, you know, it still feels great. But yeah, it's been a learning process. And I tend to pursue different things. I was making post-apocalyptic weapons out of baseball bats for a while there, and so, you know, it's I just tend to go where the creativity goes. Right now, it happens to be books and short stories again.
You think there's gonna it's like an ebbs and flows things with you, because we all hit bumps in the road that forced all our careers. Like, I mean, I was working for a copyright agency for 3.5 years, where it's you sit down to the computer at 8:30 in the morning, you don't finish till like 7 o'clock at night, and the last thing you then want to do is write, because all your words are gone. Now, like, you do 5,000 words a day and research stuff, you can't physically bring yourself to it. So do you think that'll happen to you? There'll be a point when you think, well, okay, I'm going to concentrate on something else for a while and then come back to writing again. Because writing always seems to be like a fail-safe. You backstop, you always come back to writing.
It's never intentional, like, "Well, I'm going to take a break from writing and pursue this other thing." It's more like, "Look, you know, there's a squirrel, like a dog sees the squirrel and it's got to chase it up the tree. It's like, I got to go do this for a while. And then, you know, if I feel like coming back, I will." But it's never like, I mean, I don't write, certainly not 5,000 words a day, but my work week is 4 days long. So I get up, you know, in the mornings, I usually write 2 or 3 hours, maybe 1,000 or 2,000 words, and delete half of it and go again and all that. But so I don't have it. My job is running heavy equipment, so my brain is pretty much free all day, and I make notes. I mean, I have piles of notes I've made throughout my workday on legal pads, you know, at breaks and at lunch and whatever.
I
So
mean,
yeah, I just pursue what I feel like pursuing.
running heavy equipment doesn't seem like the kind of job where you could switch your brain off anyway. You know what I mean? To me, it's just like, if you're in charge of like a 20-ton digger and whatever else, that I think if Jim switches his brain off here, that the consequences are going to be absolutely disastrous. But I guess what you do, you got the experience. You can see everything from every angle when you're doing it anyway,
Well, and that's the thing, you know, short story, well, fiction writing of any sort, I say that any writing of any sort is, it's a constant problem solving too, because you're like, "Well, this character is doing this, or in this situation, this is happening. What can I do to keep it interesting?" And you don't want to just write a bunch of fluff, which I'm sure you've noticed in my books, there's not really any fluff like that. It's, you know, one thing happens and another thing happens. But it's a constant problem solving. So if you switch your brain off, you're not solving any more problems. I mean, I even have a notepad under my bed if I wake up with an idea in the middle of the night, so I can scratch it down and go back to sleep.
See, I would never have gone that far. I mean, when I sit down and write something, I just write it and it's done, it's written. And then you go back and do the editing process. I mean, you sound like you're constantly editing all the time. So you'll write like 2,000 words, you go back and you edit. But I always go, well, let's write it and then go back in and edit afterwards.
Yeah, if I don't keep up with some of the basic editing, like, it's like building the house. You know, you got the foundation, and if I don't have my first chapter right, I'll tweak that first chapter for days until I'll start the second one. If I don't have it right, though, then it's like a jumble. It just doesn't come together right after that. So I have to have that first chapter right before I move forward. And I probably delete more words than I type up, so, or more than I leave in there.
Right. Because I mean, when we, because often things completely change. Because you go back to the beginning, you go, well, that's some work. That's not working out because that. So once you change the beginning, you find that the next chapter changes, and the chapter after that changes, and it exponentially changes. And so the book you originally started writing isn't the book you originally turn in because
Oh,
it's
yeah.
completely different. So.
Well, that, and like you might have a big reveal and realize that big reveal in chapter two should really be chapter 10 or something. You're
Right.
just pushing the story too fast. Or like the one I'm working on now, I can't quite decide if there's going to be a supernatural element or not, but it's going to be hyper violent. It's a mob enforcer who loves her job, and but I can't quite decide, does it need a supernatural angle, or can it just be her beating up and killing people and it's still working out okay?
It's just a pleasure thing. Well, I spoke to Richard Cadry a while back. He's done just wrote a book about a duo of sort of mafia enforcers, one's dead and one's alive, but they were partners throughout their career, so they got that sort of partnership in life and death going on. And that was an interesting angle. So it's kind of the same sort of ground, and it's always better to have like some sort of supernatural element in every story if you're writing
Yeah, I
horror,
agree.
just to push it forward. So when did you start thinking, well, let's make the transition from writing short stories into writing, well, music and sort of exploring that avenue? So, I mean, what did so the writing come first or music come first, or did they just sort of
I
collide at the same time?
started writing first. I started writing seriously, like I said, about 14, but I didn't pick up bass until I was 19. But one of my friends had an older brother who had a band. It was the first time I had seen a live band, in their rehearsal studio and all that. I'm like, holy shit, this is something people actually do. So we were all, me and my friend and a couple other friends, well, we're going to start a band. Well, the guy who was going to play drums never bought so much as a pair of drumsticks. And the other guys weren't really, their heart wasn't in it. So me and another buddy started playing, and then the poetry shifted to being song lyrics.
Right.
And definitely pursued that for a while, but I did write some short stories and stuff during that time as well. But music definitely was the big thing for a long time.
Because you did Zero Signal as well, which
Yeah.
was an online publication for, yeah, it was 5 years.
No, it was more like a year and a half, 2 years. It wasn't a
Was
real
it?
long thing. It was, and I'm sure you've come across this with mass movement at times. It gets down to where you're the only person really doing anything.
Yeah.
And I would, I was still doing the actual like magazine setup, even though it was digital. So one weekend a month, I was stuck in front of the computer the whole time. I had a wife and a young kid. And so one weekend a month, I was just not available for anything. And finally, I'm like, I have these people who say they're going to help. And some of them really do want to help and just can't. But I'm like, it's just too much.
Right, because you when you've got like even when it's digital, you're still doing the layout, you're doing all the content, planning the content, planning the adverts, getting everything in, making sure you hit page count because you don't want to see page count too much because people lose interest after a while,
Yeah.
and it
But we
becomes.
always kind of ended with a bunch of reviews at the back end of it. So if they got there and they didn't want to read a bunch of reviews, they didn't have to push past them in the middle of the
Right.
document.
I always put reviews sort of close to the back, but not as the last thing, just so that people would look through the reviews and see something they wanted to see, in case, because people are sending you stuff in review, and I always think, like, well, if hopefully somebody will pick up on it and read it. So let's sort of circle back to the books and the Theatre House. So Theatre House, where did the idea for that come from? Was that like a long gestating idea, or was it something that just came?
It was the escape room thing just kind of pinged in my brain one day, and it actually started out in my head was as Omega House, because for some reason I was thinking Omega was the Greek, it's always the Alpha, the Omega. So I
Yeah.
was thinking Omega is the end, it's death. And I went, wait a second, let me do a little research. And when I looked it up, it said Theta, and I like, there we go. These kids
Right.
are going to go, they're going to do this escape room challenge, and I'm going to do things, find ways to kill them that I don't want on my Google search. And we're going to go from there.
Right. So that's the thing, isn't it? Everything that pops up on Google whenever you search for something, you terrified the police are going to turn up your door one day. Explain your Google search and your Google history. It's like, oh, well, I can't really. I'm all right.
Yeah, the death of Lance Bristol, which I'm not going to tell what happened to, to spoil it, but that particular one was the one I didn't want on my Google search. So I was very careful to ask people who might actually know in person instead of like, yeah, FBI knocking on my door.
Well, that's it. Just the idea that we're constantly being monitored, they can look at this kind of stuff and find
Oh,
out.
yeah.
That's terrifying. So, were you originally going to publish Theatre House by yourself? Was it going to be yourself?
No, what I did was the months before that, I republished a novel I had written and some a collection of short stories of older stuff, and I just went through and edited it and got it, tweaked it out, and I self-published that. The point of that was to get to write something to pursue a publisher because I just don't have the ability to promote as far and wide as a legitimate publisher has. And I got Theta House finished, and I asked you, who do you think? You recommended Earth Island Books. I waited a few months because it was a holiday time, and it was right in February, end of February, 1st of March, and I just reached out to David at Earth Island again, and he's like, "I love it." It's like, I may not be the best publisher for it, as far as because they haven't, I guess they haven't done any real straight horror up until that point. But I'm like, Tim recommended you. I know he has at least three books through you, and let's do this. And now the book is, on, I think, every continent except Antarctica at this point. And, I'm getting pretty good reviews from all over the world. And I mean, I haven't made $1 million, but Theta House isn't probably the kind of story that's going to make $1 million unless Stephen King's name's on the cover. But if it's a solid underground hit, I'm happy.
There are so few of us that make a living at writing books. It's because it's more of a we do it because we like to do it,
Yeah, it's the same for any creative thing, whether you paint, you write, you make music, performance art, whatever, it's most of the people stay in the underground. It's just the way it works.
and yeah, it's a passion project, and that's all it is. So, I mean, what surprised me was that Theatre House came out, and then I get an email myself, you're the bite ready. It's like, do you not sleep? Do you not,
So once
switch your brain
again,
off?
2 or 3 hours in the mornings, 3 days a week. It's just a matter of how strong is the idea right now. Like the Bite was, there was an, I have Theta House out, we're promoting it, but then the Bite has had this really strong urgency too. So I plowed through it, I edited it, I changed things. My wife is my proofreader. She went through it. I go back through it again and again, probably after that. Because by the time I turn it in, it's the, I want the editing to be basically final edit, perfect. And
But
but there was an urgency, like the one I'm working on right now, I don't feel that urgency, but I have two books that I'm promoting, another one that's waiting in the wings, so I feel it more like I have time with this one to, I don't have to, I don't feel rushed, which is basically.
that's the idea is to because we all think, oh, well, we're reaching a certain age and we've got to get our stuff out and make it out there kind of stuff. But I think a lot of us tend to feel like Roger Moore didn't play James Bond until he was 46 years old.
Yeah.
So there is time. We're not limited by we've got to get out, we've got to push out. Because life experience, I think, has been the greatest sort of educator as far as how things work,
Yeah.
literally for me. I'm certainly now, I think I'm having worked those crappy copyright jobs, I know I'm certainly a better writer and better editor than I was 10 years ago. Which brings me round to the next point, the horror anthology that you're now going to be a part of as well.
Yes, that was when David first mentioned the horror anthology. I'm like, well, okay, let's. I had an idea. A lot of my ideas come from dreams and nightmares. So the first story I submitted to you, Warhog, was it was actually a military unit, but it was the same creatures. And then David's like, well, we're a punk rock DIY ethic kind of thing, so I changed it into a punk band. Well, I'm a huge Ramones fan, so Warhog is taken from Warthog.
With the song Dee Dee sang on Too Tough to Die.
Exactly. And then the bass player in that story, his name is Calvin Glass, and Dee Dee's real name is Douglas Colvin. So, there are some Ramones references in it, but I'm like, this makes it's a lot of fun. It's basically an action adventure piece, but the creatures are, it's monsters instead of people. And so I'm like, well, this should be good for that. And I really like to develop characters. I don't want them to be boring. I like my characters to stand out from each other. And so that was a lot of fun. And then the second story I submitted to you, the Shaw's Peak, was another one. I had a dream about a guy base jumping off the Great Pyramid of Giza. And because I'm not good at happy endings, it turned out, the way it did. but it's written in a completely different style of storytelling from Warhol. It's not as how would you say it? Almost unreliable narrator, except it is still linear.
Right. So do you find it easy to jump between different stylistically, to jump between different points of view when you're writing and to sort of adopt a different sort of narrative flow and style?
If the story idea is right, I like Shaw's Peak's almost stream of consciousness the way the story is written, and but that's just the way the idea came to me. It wasn't like I'm gonna write it this way. It was just like this is the way the story is. This is how it feels, and I just went with it.
Because one of the things, I've always thought with writers is if you spend some time as a ghostwriter, it exponentially improves what you do because you see the world through somebody else's eyes and you have to essentially become that person. So now that your books are out there, how does it feel to have those physical copies in your hand, to actually
Oh,
see
it's
them in the
amazing.
new world?
It's amazing. I have a few copies on a shelf in the living room, and then I have a copy of Theta House and the Bight on those little easels you get to put family photos on. So they're on the shelf with some extra copies behind them. So if people come over, I'm like, well, here, have a copy of this. But that way, sitting there watching TV and they're always right there in my peripheral vision, I can look at it and go, hey, there's a Earth Island book stamps on there. And that's not me through Amazon Publishing anymore. That's somebody who's really out there and believes in it, is pushing it, who is for the cover art. What do I think? Well, I'm not an artist like that. I want something eye-catching. Okay, well, what about this? That's beautiful. The artist gave their interpretation of my work. And I mean, looking over there like that, knowing that that full process is there, it really feels good. I can look over there and smile every time.
So, I mean, you've been doing like promotional events as well in the local area, like writers' fairs.
Yeah, little small ones. We had the one indie writers event, which we did last year for the first time, and then in September for the second time. And then we have like there's one venue that does psych night once a month, and what they do is they have psychedelic bands play, if you call them that. And then they have vendors. So I've sat up at a couple of those, and I want to say I tend to sell about five books an event. So it's getting it out there for sure, but I haven't been at an event since I've had physical copies of The Bite yet. So I think with two different titles to sell, I'll probably sell maybe five of each. I don't know, but I haven't set up at an event like that yet.
So, how does it feel being? I mean, I find it weird trying to promote my stuff rather than promoting somebody else. Because as a writer through Mass Movement and all the other publications I've written for as a journalist, I'm constantly promoting somebody else's work, and then trying to make that shift to promote my own was kind of odd
I can
and really
imagine.
uncomfortable that way. I don't know if you felt the same way.
Not so much. I don't, other than like, I do promote some of the other Earth Island authors and friends who are writers, but I don't approach it like I do, of course, put most of my focus on my own stuff, and the other people are like, and you should also check this out. But I was so used to promoting my own stuff on my own that it's more like, okay, what can I add to what I've been doing? And, Earth Island's like, well, we have this. And I'm like, oh, okay, let me see what I can do. One of the things I like to do is I get business cards made where the front of the business card is the cover of the book, and then the back has the information to track it down. And I'll go to like the bookstore and grab the first Stephen King bestseller off the shelf and tuck a business card in it. I do that at the bookstores, the library, the little free libraries. I'll go and, all right, well, this book might be close enough to somebody who would be interested, and I'll just tuck business cards in it and keep on going.
See, I never even thought about doing stuff like that. It's like, guerrilla publicity. It's fantastic. It's a really, really good idea.
Well,
So,
in all the years you spend making flyers when you play in bands, it's like that you got to get that stuff everywhere. So how do business card right inside of a book cover on your way, and
I
people are
mean,
going to buy
and
that first Stephen King book off the shelf.
that card's going to be in there. So, why should people buy Theatre House? And why should people buy The Bite? Over to you, Jim.
If they
Back
like
up for publicity, go for it. Tell everyone.
stories where bad things happen to people that aren't real, and they like, well, if they're not too keen on happy endings, but they like characters that stand apart from each other through dialogue, through description, you're not just going to get a bunch of bland people. You're going to have interesting people. Bad things are going to happen to them, and at the end, you're going to get kicked that one last time. And then you're either going to go, man, that was a little too fast, or holy crap, what's next?
Well, I couldn't have put it better myself. So, Jim, what's next for you? I mean, you mentioned that there's this. We know you're going to be in the anthology, and we know that there's the third book on the way.
Yeah, I'm working
Have
on
you?
one called Botcher that's the mob enforcer.
Right.
And so right now I'm focused on the promotion for Data House and the Bight, and then the other thing is Botcher right now. So,
And so you're
but I
not looking
always have a
further down the
project
line.
in them.
Are you looking
Sorry,
further
go ahead.
down the line? Is there anything else you've got plans? Like, because at the rate you write, Botch is going to be out by March anyway.
Maybe so, yeah.
I mean, what comes after March?
I don't know. Like I said, I have notes, piles of notes. Some of them will be titles. Some of them might be a snatch of dialogue or a description. I have always have multiple notebooks, legal pads, the backs of whatever piece of paper is handy. So it's, I have another book that's been in the process for a year and a half that's a little quirkier and stuff. There's just always multiple things brewing. It's just a matter of which one am I focused on right now.
Well, Jim, it has been an absolute pleasure to actually talk to you last face to face
I know, wow.
after a couple of decades. So if there's anything else you'd like to add, now's the time. Or, forever hold your peace until the next time. Well, until the
I
next.
mean, yeah, I mean, buy my books, buy everybody's books. There are never too many books on the shelf.
Jim, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Now, Tim, it's wonderful to actually see you face to face. I see we have the same hairline going
Dude. We are close shaven, is the way I like to say. Be bold, be cool.
I'm in a recession.
That's one way of looking at it, I guess. And it's a proper way of looking at it. You got to go the full hog like me. The ladies love a clean head, but well, the ladies love a clean head. Take it easy, Jim. I'll speak to you soon, brother.
All right, Tom. See you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was Jim Dodge talking about his new books, The Bight and Theta House, which have just been published by Earth Island Books. So without further ado, let's move on to Ali Wilkes, who's just had her new novel, Where the Dead Wait, published by Titan Books. So here's Ali.
I can hear you. We're now recording so this can go on the cast properly. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. It's so nice of you to have me on.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure. So we've just literally this morning where the dead weight arrived. It popped through the letterbox this morning. So you're gonna have to fill in all the blanks in the book as we go. But what I am curious though is how did the criminal barrister end up as a horror author?
Well, it's kind of a long story. I've been obsessed with horror all my life, always been a horror fan. And while I was still at the criminal bar, obviously not very much free time, one of my biggest treats was that every single year I would go to Fright Fest in August in Leicester Square. So
Yeah.
I'd go and I'd have the full festival pass. I would watch 25 horror films over the course of a weekend. And that was what I did to unwind. So I sort of kept my love for horror alive, even when everything else in my life was very, very different, all courts, trials, juries, that sort of thing. But as I went on, I started wanting to escape back to horror, back to my love of horror a lot more. And it all sort of came to a head probably about 8 or 9 years ago, when I found myself in the weekends working as a zombie scare actor at an immersive horror experience in Whitechapel, which was called the Generation of Zed. So I would literally spend my weeks at court, spend my weekends coated in blood, running around an underground maze,
Okay.
scaring the shit out of audience members. Going back into court on Monday, really hoarse, voice really hoarse from all the screeching. And more and more, I had a sense that what I loved was horror and what made me feel alive and feel like I was really enjoying my life was horror. So I wanted to prioritize that over what I was doing at the time, which was, of course, meaningful. Very meaningful in its own
Right.
way. It wasn't something that was making me feel good. So
It was meaningful for the rest of the world, but it was just the A to B for you.
Exactly. Exactly. you know, I could have been a barrister for the rest of my life. But actually, as time went on, I realized that what I would find meaningful would be working in the horror world and telling these sort of horror stories and sort of really immersing myself in what I love to do.
Right. So how did you successfully make the transition from barrister to professional writer? Because I know how difficult it is to have anything published and then to turn around and say, well, I'm a professional writer. When we all know, you know, as writers, how little money there actually is in the field, because it's next to impossible to make a living at it.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie, it is a tough world, and it was a tough transition. I was monumentally lucky, and I will say that every time anyone asks me about that, because I was able to transition from being a criminal barrister, which is not perhaps the most well-funded part of the bar, to working in a sort of internal inquiry sort of team for a major commercial bank, to being a full-time author. And while I was working at the bank, not only was I able to build up savings, but because it was more of a 9-to-5 sort of job, I didn't have to take work home. I was able to do stuff like, I went on the Curtis Brown Literary Agency novel writing course, which is like 6 months in the evenings here in London. So I was able to sort of start moving myself out of the law and into being an author. And the course gave me not only an opportunity to think very seriously about my writing and really sort of hone the craft, but also it gave me, I have to say, all the know-how I needed to actually approach agents, and probably kickstarted my career a bit in that way as well, because it sort of hooked me more into the literary world, gave me the confidence to approach other professionals.
Right. So let's talk about We're the Dead Weight, because it's got one of a tagline. You know, the idea that the terror meets Yellow Jackets. That is enough to sell anybody on the novel, as far as I'm concerned. So how would you describe the story?
I'd describe it as the story of a very traumatized and fucked up Victorian Arctic explorer who should have been lauded for getting most of his men out of the Arctic on a doomed expedition, or so he thinks. But actually, this sort of like this bad reputation has dogged him his entire life, because at the end of the day, what happened was murder, survival, cannibalism, a ship lost, all that sort of stuff that doesn't exactly endear you to either the British public or the Admiralty. So he's lived under a cloud his entire life, and he is given sort of a once in a lifetime opportunity to redeem himself by going back to the Arctic to rescue someone who was extremely close to him on that expedition, who has managed to get himself lost in the Arctic for a second time. So it's sort of a quest for redemption, but it also throws up a lot of extremely knotty problems for him and those around him as to exactly what happened on the first expedition and whether it's right or it's wrong that he is haunted by what he did.
So it's somebody coped with survivor's guilt, being thrown back into the sort of same environment that caused him to. Yeah, that is, yeah. So it's more of an explanation, as I said, of survivor guilt than.
Yes.
Okay, the story.
There's a lot about survivor's guilt. There's a lot about the sort of horrible decisions you might have to make in order to survive in such extreme conditions. Questions of culpability, questions of personal responsibility, that sort of thing. And at its heart is the story of two men. One, the fucked up Victorian explorer. Secondly, his second in command that he's got to go and rescue this time, and the interaction between the two of them, which is a very sort of odd, mutually destructive, sort of predatory relationship. And that's where a lot of the horror comes in.
Oh, so it's the typical battle for alpha male, but then.
Not quite, not quite. I wonder if anyone would describe my protagonist, William Day, as an alpha male. He's certainly something. I think the dynamic that a lot of people would describe it as is a very Hannibal, Will Graham sort of relationship.
So a mentor-student thing that goes slightly astray.
Yeah, I think that's definitely one way to put it. And with the Yellow Jackets comparison, it's sort of about examining what happened in a very traumatic time, in a very traumatic place, a long way off, and whether people's recollection of the events or what they say about the events can be trusted at all.
So as well, again, so like the idea of trauma-led horrors, it is a fascinating one because everybody's experiences are different anyway. It's all about personal interpretation.
I think that's correct. And coming back to our earlier discussion about my time at the criminal bar, one of the things I learned so powerfully then was that when you're in the midst of a traumatic experience, everyone reacts very, very differently, and people's memories can become very, very distorted. We have this tendency to think of memory as being like a tape recorder running in your head, but actually, if you re-examine memory and re-examine trauma, it's not like that at all. Things have the potential to be really, really bent out of shape, either in the telling or the replaying, and I just find that very fascinating.
Of course, there's this psychological idea as well that because there's gaps in memory and people don't remember things exactly as they happened, your imagination and your own your own sort of cerebellum fills in those missing gaps anyway. So the truth is the exact truth.
Yeah, and that's where I find a very fertile place for the supernatural, because if you can't really trust your own recollections, it leaves, as you say, this sort of lacuna, this sort of gap in the memory. And in Where the Dead Wait, that's very powerfully where the sort of supernatural starts clawing out of the shadows and starts haunting people.
So, I mean, you've mentioned before that you are a lifelong horror fan, but everybody's journey starts somewhere. So can you pinpoint the moment when you thought, this is me, this is what I love? What inspired that sort of moment?
I think, like so many British kids of around my generation, it's got to be the Usborne World of the Unknown books. I don't know anyone who didn't powerfully love those books. And right now, even, I would sell my soul for one of those 700 quid on eBay bind-ups with the skull with the glowing eyes on the cover. That's what I had back then. And it was my Bible. I would read that thing through until the pages wore thin. And it really was that I was obsessed with that and everything that came out of it. So I would like try and fake my own ghost photographs and things. I had like a Polaroid camera, and I collected like local folk legends and ghost house stories. And of course, you know, going to stately homes as a child, because that's what you did. You'd get all these wild like stories and postcards and things. And it really sort of grew out of that. Like, I was always obsessed with the supernatural and the spooky. In fact, one of the things I have sitting on my, hanging on my wall next to my desk as we talk, is the cover of the very first horror book I ever wrote. And I was about 8. I will show it to you. I don't know if it comes up well on the camera. It is called The Thing That Came Out of the Night.
See, that could be the title of a Hammer film. From the 50s.
Exactly. Yeah. And we've got the graveyard, we've got the gravestone, we've got like the wolf claw coming from behind it, got some spooky eyes, you know, we've got everything. So that really tells you what sort of kid I was. So it's entirely unnatural. It's entirely natural, rather, that if you scratch me, horror comes out.
I mean, it's always fascinating to find someone who's inspired more by literary horror than they are by cinematic horror or visual horror, because being of a certain age when, I mean, during the 80s, because I'm a latchkid, my parents didn't care what I watched. So I would, you know, if Dracula's on my, well, it keeps him quiet. Let's put him in front of that. If you see Christopher Lee, see Peter Cushing. But I'm always fascinated to find out that somebody is inspired more by the literary face thing. So
if there was a
carry on.
Sorry, I was going to say that I think one of the big reasons for that, and sort of I went on from Usborne's World of the Unknown straight into like point horror. Point horror was my next thing. I was obsessed with point horror. But I think one of the reasons why I didn't go through the sort of cinematic phase, the sort of VHS stage that a lot of my contemporaries did, is because from the age of 9, I was at boarding school. And one of the things I can tell you about boarding schools at that time period is they didn't let you watch TV and they didn't let you watch videotapes. You know, if you wanted horror and you didn't want to watch the National Lottery Live or Casualty, although great affection for Casualty, that stuff was quite wild sometimes. If you didn't want to watch the National Lottery Live, which is one of the very few approved programs, or Neighbours, you really would be sort of sitting in the library rather than the TV room reading point horror or the Big Book of Werewolf Stories or whatever. So I think that's why I didn't go through that sort of VHS tape phase, because I spent so long in an environment in which you really couldn't watch TV or films or anything.
So you reach out for the genre that you love through the only, you know, medium you have, which is literature, which is fascinating, because the genre that inspires you eventually is the career that you enter as well. So it's like a cyclical thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I went to the launch of Danny Robbins' new book, The Uncanny Book, a couple of months ago now, I think. And I found it very meaningful because he was talking about how he had reached a stage in his life in which he didn't really seem able to land things. Nothing really seemed to stick on the surface. He'd got this career and he really wasn't sure what he was doing with it, etc. And he went straight back to what he loved when he was a child, which was ghost stories. And I had to go up to him afterwards and go like, "What? Me too. Absolutely. It's come full circle for both of us."
So if there was a writer that you pinpoint that helped you on your journey and made you suddenly realize, yes, this is what I want to do, who would it be?
Ooh, gosh, that's a very difficult question. I think I've always got to give a shout out to those point horror authors of my youth, because they were doing some really interesting trailblazing stuff, including Caroline B. Cooney. What an absolute legend. I think because there wasn't much horror around in the British literary scene back then, because as I'm sure you probably remember, it was all like everything was, there was Stephen King and there was James Herbert. And that was basically it. We didn't have like a horror section in bookstores. It was just very lacking. So one of the authors that I really got into when I was about 14 was Ramsay Campbell and his short stories. The Inhabitant of the Lake, what a collection, things like that. And that was my first introduction to sort of Lovecraftiana and that sort of cosmic horror, the idea of the world being much darker and horrible underneath than our mere mortal brains can comprehend. And I would describe what I write now as very heavily influenced by cosmic horror as a genre. In fact, I over the summer, I put out an indie press novella called Jamie Hallow and the End of the World, which is a sort of neo-Lovecraftian end of the world romp, which is really sort of my love letter to that sort of tentacle monsters and more side of the genre.
So, I mean, that, you know, you're talking my language, because I am a massive Lovecraft fan. Not the man, his work, yes. The man was, as we know, slightly abhorrent. But Ramsay Campbell picked up that mantle and ran with it and has crafted and made something wonderful out of something that could be seen as awful.
I know. One of the first things I did when I was really getting into literary horror Twitter, I was like, guys, I'll set you a puzzle. This is a story that has stuck with me all my life, which is a story about two men who agree to engage in a ritual which strips back all the veils that hide human perception from what's really there. And it sort of ends with someone going, no, that can't be you, sort of, you know, the gelatinous form. No, it can't. Ah! And I sort of put that out on my Twitter and was like, guys, this story has haunted me my entire life. What is it? And then Ramsey Campbell came into my mentions and was like, oh, yes, that's my The Render of the Veils. And it's like, yes, of course it is. Fine. Yeah, so while I don't necessarily agree with most of Lovecraft's abhorrent personal views, his style of writing was very influential on me. And one of the things I think so great about modern horror is we do have so many amazing authors, including queer authors and people of colour, who are really reclaiming Lovecraft's work and writing in a Lovecraft type inspired universe, a mythos inspired sort of cosmic universe, whilst gleefully trampling all over what old Howard probably held dear.
I think that, you know, Howard's problem wasn't that he hated everything. I think he was just scared of everything, which is what made him such a fantastic writer, because he was just so terrified of the world at large. He was trying to make sense of his own fear.
Exactly. It's fear of the other, which is one of the most powerful sources of horror we have. Fear of the what is other, what is foreign, what is incomprehensible to us. And where I think the script has been very neatly flipped in modern times is that, in particular, a lot of queer authors are coming round and saying, well, I always felt growing up like I was the other, I was the monstrous, I was the incomprehensible, and approaching cosmic horror and sort of monster horror from that perspective, and you get a whole different take on it. And, you know, that's really running with, I think, a lot of the work that Clive Barker laid down back in the day.
But is it, again, that sense of the other, with especially queer authors, but is that the fall of society when you flip the coin, because it's the individual versus society? Society makes you feel like the other when you're being alienated by the thing that should be embracing you. So horror then becomes, you see society as being the thing that subjugates you.
Almost. Yeah. Yeah, and there's so much interesting work being done in that genre at the moment in terms of how horror can hold up a mirror to society and what society's predominant fears and hopes are. It's, you know, it's a very thinky genre is horror, I think, and it's a very empathetic genre, and it requires you to, as a writer and as a reader, to empathize deeply. And that, I think, is where someone like HPL falls down, because, let's be honest, his protagonists are way for thin. But it gives the crack that so many people are inserting themselves into, and it creates an opportunity to sort of really explode the universe out from there.
So, I mean, you've made the point of horror, especially for those of us who are fans, is very empathetic, sort of all-encompassing, intelligent genre. But the mainstream has a very different view of it. So why do you think the mainstream view of horror is so dismissive as a whole? Is it down to writers like Sean Hudson who made it? I mean, bless Sean, you know, lovely chap, but his books weren't exactly inspiring or intelligent, unless you love guns.
Yeah, it's a very big question why so many people look down on horror, but they do, don't they?
Yeah.
And a lot of the time it comes with this sort of distaste, this idea that you are somehow a bad person for wanting to engage with horror, for wanting to read about or watch horrific scenarios. And I find it deeply hypocritical, because often the same people who I meet who say things like, oh, I couldn't possibly watch a horror film, or I couldn't read about that, it's too nasty, they're exactly the sort of people I find often who would have no problem picking up a true crime podcast, for example, or reading that particular genre of book, which is, you know, my parents did something awful to me when I was a child, and I'm going to tell you about it in deeply salacious detail. But for some reason, that never gets shelved as horror or thought of as horror. Horror seems to occupy this weird place in people's minds where it's both distasteful and unserious. And I'm not quite sure how we've got there, to be honest, because with the roots of horror and literary horror, horror has always been incredibly serious. If you go right back to where the genre, I think, was arguably invented, like Frankenstein, you can't get any more earnest than Frankenstein as a book, I don't think.
And the genre was sort of forged and helped to become part of the public zeitgeist by incredible writers like, you know, like Poe. I mean, Poe arguably changes the face of horror and then influences the writers who follow him, and then the writers who follow them are influenced by those writers. So you have, it's all traced back to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, which again is the genesis of science fiction as well as the genesis of horror, and it's an earnest work. And this is one of the things that, again, annoys me, in that horror always seems to have lacked a sort of female perspective. It's always the biggest writers are the male writers. These are the writers you should read. Stephen King's an incredibly talented writer. But you need to have, I think, the female voice to temper it and tell stories which are frankly terrifying to the male psyche.
Yes, I think that is true. I personally do feel frustration when it's generally someone on the internet, someone on Reddit is like, oh, you know, I'm really looking for some good horror books to read. And literally the first 10 posts will be people jumping in going, oh, have you heard of Stephen King? And I think by now we can take it that we're all aware of the absolute giant of horror that is Stephen King. And similarly, you know, you've got the people who would appear alongside Stephen King on the bookshelves. And you can rattle off the names of, say, 10 or so very, very well-known male horror authors. But there's a particular subset of horror fandom that would really struggle, I think, to name a female horror author, which is bonkers to me, because at the moment, I would say horror writership is probably in the 50-50s. Certainly in terms of, if you look at big things like StokerCon, if you look at things like the Bram Stoker Awards, if you look at the sort of landscape of what's being put out there horror-wise, I would say it's starting to achieve gender balance. But for some reason, that's often overlooked in the popular eye.
It just seems insane. I mean, we've reached a point, we're in the 21st century, when Stephen King is still the biggest writer in horror, arguably so, as we've said. But you know, you look at a genre like fantasy, and Ursula Le Guin is a name that immediately springs to mind. But nobody would say that the same thing about horror yet, because they would always go for the big three.
Yeah, you know, yeah. It's very, very strange, I think. And I think in terms of horror, we're entering a really, as I keep saying, a really amazing age in which all these different perspectives are coming through, all these different sort of outsider perspectives are coming through, whether it's women, whether it's LGBTQIA folks, whether it's people of colour, whether it's indigenous voices, that sort of thing. They're all coming through, and the genre is getting incredibly rich and diverse, and all these very meaty stories are being told. And as a sidebar, I don't say that only someone of a particular demographic can tell, a female story. I mean, like, one of the reads of last year has got to be Mary by Nat Cassidy, hasn't it? Which is about a perimenopausal woman. And it's written by Nat, and he is absolutely exceptional. He nails it. But I do think that with the injection of different voices comes more richness. And it's just so frustrating when everyone seems to want to go back to the 70s as being the heyday, and it's all these very, very samey stories, I find.
But is that because people are looking back to their childhood, or looking back to things that inspire them, and they're finding solace in those things, and the world is becoming increasingly crazy? I'm trying to pinpoint a reason for maybe it's more of a nostalgia thing than...
It could be a nostalgia thing, a wanting to go back to a time when things were more simple, that sort of thing. But I would say that if you genuinely using horror as a way to cope with real life, which I think a lot of us do. And studies have shown that we're more psychologically healthy for doing. Thanks to The Guardian. But if you're looking to engage with real life through horror, I mean, there are great books being written now which tap into absolutely everything that's going on around us these days. I mean, all through the pandemic, you had this like flowering of horror literature. And it was almost the return of the haunted house story, wasn't it? Because everyone was stuck in their, well, people who weren't essential workers who did a cracking job were all stuck in their own houses and forced to engage with the idea of what if this house is haunted? So we had a sort of flowering of the haunted house genre. And at the same time, you had stuff put out that engaged with the pandemic, even though it wasn't written during the pandemic, like Paul Tremblay's Survivor Song. So I would say that if you know, if you're looking to engage with the real world through horror, there's a lot more modern stuff that is doing all of that. There's no need, unless you're doing it for nostalgia purposes, it's all out of an earnest desire to reread the classics. There's no need to go backwards.
Okay, so let's get back to Where the Dead Wait. And you mentioned that Ramsay Campbell's played a big part in your formative career. So if there's a writer, just to try and pull more readers in that inspired Where the Dead Wait in it stylistically, who would you say those writers were? Who would you pinpoint?
Well, when I think about writers that I've always wanted to emulate with my work's always very like snowy, icy, cold place horror so far. And for me, the real giant of that is Michelle Paver. I think she is absolutely excellent. Her Dark Matter and Thin Air are two of the scariest extreme survival books I've ever come across. They're absolutely chilling, no pun intended. And what I think she has done, which I try to emulate, is look for those little details that are unique to the setting and frightening, such as the idea in Dark Matter that when you go out in the snow in the dead of night in snowshoes, and there's only you, the auditory qualities of the space means that it'll sound like someone is walking just behind you, stopping when you stop. And that's a thrilling detail that she uses to absolute best effect. And I think that really inspired me to start looking for these very specific, very sort of nuggety details that could conjure up an atmosphere in my own writing. And then, of course, you've got the giants of historical horror that I, you know, that I think can't help but have influenced my work, like Alma Katsu, who writes just this extraordinary blend of historical true events and the supernatural. And of course, I can't help again but have been influenced by Dan Simmons' The Terror, because that really is the big one. And growing up at a time I did, of course, that was one of the giant chonky books on my bookshelf. And it's a chonker. It's much longer than mine, I have to say. But of course, I would have read that and been absolutely blown away at the idea that you could meld this very human, very extreme survival story with a supernatural and in places psychological horror story. It's a pretty unique mashup, and it does it very well.
Okay, so this is a question I love to ask more writers. Sell your work to the people who are listening to this. Sell your book. Publicize it. Do what the PRs do, but do it better, because I know you can. It's your work. It's from your heart. You know better than anyone. Sell it.
Do you like historical horror? Do you like things to be really creepy? Really scary? But do you also want to see people falling down crevasses and ice holes and having to self-amputate limbs due to frostbite? Are you, or do you want to read about queer characters in historical situations? If this all sounds like you, you may want to read All the White Spaces or Where the Dead Wait, in both of which I take my love of the historic age of Antarctic and Arctic exploration, throw in a dollop of nameless, possibly cosmic dread, possibly ghosts. I'm not telling you, you'll have to read for yourself. and then dial up the tension to 11 with natural disasters and all the really gory, gruesome stuff that happens at the extreme cold places of the world.
Absolutely perfect. Absolutely perfect. Ali, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today. And I am looking forward to reading the book. And when the review goes live, I will send you the link.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening to Jim and Ali talk about their new books, and I hope you both all go out and buy copies of them as soon as you possibly can and read them, because they are all absolutely brilliant. So, as ever, that was Jim Dodge talking about Theta House and The Bite, published by Earth Island Books, and Ali Wilkes talking about Where the Dead Wait, published by Titan Books. So go out, get the books, read them, enjoy them, and I'll see you next time. Ta-ta!